Oyez, oyez, the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you so much. Y'all can be seated. Thank you. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. Justice Ellis and Justice Crump and I welcome you here today. This is cause number 0324794CR, Lee Christopher Vaughn versus the State of Texas. Councils, please introduce yourself and announce whether you're ready or not.
Case Darwin, appearing on behalf of Mr. Vaughn. We're ready, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Daniel Ludmier from the Hays County Criminal District Attorney's Office. I represent the State of Texas, and we're ready.
Thank you so much. Councils, as you are probably aware, this matter is being broadcast live on our YouTube channel, so it'll be available after the proceeding for you to review if you would like. Also, as you know, each side has 20 minutes this morning, and our warning system with regard to timing will let you know how you are proceeding in your argument. Green means you've got the 20 minutes. Yellow means you've got 2 minutes left, so you'll need to wrap up, and red means you need to conclude your argument. I understand that the appellant will start with 15 to open, and then the appellee will have 20, and then you'll wrap up with 5. Is that accurate, councils?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. Also, councils, before you get started, in light of the nature of this case, we are very familiar with the record, and we are familiar with the facts. You do not have to advise us of the facts. We see this as more of a legal argument, and therefore, if you will focus your presentation to the court today on the legal arguments in light of the nature of this case, we are prepared to take those arguments today. And so you may be able, if you were preparing your arguments with fact heavy, you may be able to give us some time back and yourself some time back to go work for your other clients, but however you prepared for your argument today. I will now hear from the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Certainly.
May it please the court. I believe that the fundamental question here before y'all today is whether the state on the day of trial can literally eliminate an element that they have alleged that must be proved. So there's two issues here in front of you. One is if there error? And the second question is if there's error, what are you going to do about it? The state, they focus very greatly on this Golihar case, which talks about legal sufficiency and variances between the evidence and the indictment itself. And they say that will look the Burrell exception that was eliminated through that case. But if you go into that same case and you go into footnote 12, what the court says exactly is the court overrules Burrell versus State. Burrell, however, did not involve sufficiency of the evidence. Burrell held that amending an indictment to remove allegations that were unnecessarily pled, but that described an element of the offense was an impermissible amendment of substance. So Burrell's analysis of indictment amendment should not be applied to the different question of evidence sufficiency. Though the sufficiency analysis may in some cases, like Curry, include an analysis of whether an amendment was proper, the two issues should not be confused. So those two issues should not be conflated. Your honors are probably way more read in on sufficiency of the law type evidence. But just to focus then on the difference between an amendment and an abandonment, is where I want to go. The indictment or the information as a trial lawyer is the most fundamental document. Every attorney, if I'm handed discovery, the document that's up on top is the indictment or the information. If I'm printing out discovery, the document that is up top is the indictment or the information, because that is the most fundamental document. It states typically the statute, but you can allege more than the statute. And the thing is, when the state unnecessarily alleges additional elements, they have to prove that
Excuse me, Mr. Darwin.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about, to your point, if we could kind of move to this. In your opinion, was the change to the indictment an abandonment or an amendment under ESTOP?
It was absolutely an amendment. It was not an abandonment. It's not surplusage. To intentionally or knowingly displaying of harmful material, that's intentionally or knowingly is a mens rea. That is an element in and of itself. In Chavez v. State, 843 Southwest 2nd, 586, that is a Texas Court of Criminal Appeals case, good law. It says the state must prove any additional elements placed into the indictment. And in that same case, they actually basically, Judge Baird, in the concurring opinion in that case, basically lays out that the Burrell exception literally is pretty much that. That if the state is going to put additional elements into the indictment or the information, it's got to be proven. You know, I once had a case, to answer your question, violation of protective order. Now, violation of protective order, when I was a younger attorney, it was a misdemeanor. It doesn't have a mens rea requirement for say is typically is involved. You just have to know that there is a protective order. So you don't have to intentionally or knowingly violate the protective order. You have to know the protective order. And in that case, my client, on the very last day that protective order was going to expire, he went and violated it because he thought it had already expired. So my argument, obviously, the jury was that he did not intentionally or knowingly violate that protective order because he thought it was expired. And so the state put into there the extra element, and the state had to prove that element because that's what was put into the information. Now, the state didn't have to do that, and the state didn't have to do that here. But I think the fundamental question you'll have before you is, are you going to condone allowing, and I know as Chief Justice, you were saying some of these facts aren't very savory, and I get that. But this also is going to be very important for every other type of case that's going to be coming before you and in this state. I just don't think that's proper for the state to be eliminating something so germane out of an information or a charging document.
So in your opinion, did Section 43.42 plainly dispense with a culpable mental state?
Section 43.42? I'm not, I'll be honest, top of my head, I'm not aware of that section. Which section is that?
Pull it up.
Oh, you're talking about the statute in and of itself. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, because
going
into the
displaying of the material.
Yeah, it does have that you know the material is harmful, but there's a difference between knowing a material is harmful and intentionally or knowingly displaying harmful material. Take my client, in this case, and the fact actually goes directly to this. He allegedly took a young person and was trying to buy Playgirl magazines and went to 5 gas stations. Now, those gas stations are displaying Playgirl magazines. They weren't in this case, but they can. Now, you know that material is harmful if you are doing that. Are you intentionally or knowingly displaying harmful material? The answer to that is no, because you have it, I presume, covered some way that minors will not have access to that. So they didn't have to plead it that way, but they did, and that directly fed into my client's defense, who his whole defense was this was done for educational purposes. So he didn't intentionally or knowingly display harmful material because, in his opinion, it wasn't viewed to be that way. That would be the difference, I would say, between those two scienters to your question, and that kind of fit in with my violation of the protective order example, because you are right, there is sort of already a particular mental element that is placed into that statute, not your typical mental element. One thing that I do want to be clear upon is what are you going to do about it? having prepared for this oral argument and done more research, I agree that if you do find error, I would concede to the court that it's not automatically reversible because they put in the harmless error standard. And from what my research generated, the only thing at this point that might be automatically reversible is a structural error. If the U.S. Supreme Court has stated that something is structural, and I concede that in this context, the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't gone to the level of saying it was structural. So there will be a statutory analysis out of 2810, which substantially prejudices the right of somebody. And that's kind of in the statute that sort of tracks the harmless error statute. But I do not see ever, and I'm not saying per se, but pretty close, how I respectfully submit, I don't know if this court wants to be putting law out there that the state can just eliminate an unnecessary element that they've already pled literally on the day of trial when everybody's prepared for their case. And it's sitting there, you know, you walk into trial, you've prepped for that trial. And that was actually the fundamental defense, was it used for educational purposes? And I get that's an affirmative defense, which a defendant has to prove. But what happened here was essentially burden shifting, because the difference between intentionally or knowingly displaying harmful material is something the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And here, when that was eliminated, that transferred that over to the defense having to prove as an affirmative defense whether it was done for educational purposes or not.
But how did it transfer anything? You still had to prove your affirmative defense whether or not the state was able to prove eliminating the one element about intentional or knowingly. They still had to prove that your client displayed harmful material. They still had to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. That was their burden. If they proved that, you still had a preponderance of the evidence to prove your affirmative defense. That never went away. You always had that burden. So it didn't really shift anything. You always had that burden. Isn't that true? That burden was always there.
100% that what you're saying is true, but if I was trying the case, I'd have been arguing both, and I would have been hammering more on the intentionally or knowingly element, because the state would have had to disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a higher standard. So that's where I submit that the harm is coming in. And I do think that the state, respectfully do think this court should give some credence also to the legislature here. I mean, the past, it's a mandatory statute that they wrote in the past. That's why it was automatically reversible. I understand that the law has changed recently, although it's never been explicitly overruled in that context with this issue. But it still goes to legislative intent to show that they don't want this type of stuff happening on the day of trial, which makes sense.
Is there anything in our analysis, as we look at statutory construction, and is there anything that we have to look at, as you've seen in statutory construction, with regard to the word surplusage? Do we go to the common usage and look at the dictionary? What does that word mean? It means extra words, words that are not necessary. And you look at that, that's what surplus means. And then you look at these words that were placed in the information and go, well, they're not in the statute, therefore they equal surplus. They struck those. And doesn't that meet the third prong of abandonment? And therefore, you've got abandonment versus amendment. Isn't that the way typical appellate courts look at how you construe things and what was intended in analyzing how we're supposed to determine what the legislature meant as we analyze whether it's an amendment versus an abandonment. Just go to the common usage of surplusage.
Well, yeah, I think you have to go back to Burrell. Is it legally descriptive of an element, the quote surplusage or additional information? And here it is. Surplusage, in my opinion, is more like, somebody threatened somebody with deadly conduct by pointing the gun at them. And then later was waving it in the air. I mean, you wouldn't have to necessarily have the waving it in the air. I mean, there's stuff that's not an element. Here, they literally, the state put an element into the information that they did not need to do. I can see that, and they should not have done that. But it was literally on the day of trial. And I was thinking, too, I'd have to double check on this. But you have motions to quash, for example, from the defense side. I do not believe that on the day of trial, motions to quash are timely. And there's probably a reason why that is, because here you are at trial and you got the charging document. And you're trying to, at the day of trial, literally, you're trying to sit here and strike the charging document. And that's something that needs to be double checked, but it goes to the whole point of notice and fairness. And on the day of trial.
Is there anything to the fact that the trial counsel did not seek a continuance at all of the 10 days or anything to pause the trial to give your client 10 days notice? Is there anything at all there with regard to trial counsel's actions?
That, and to his actions in that sense, I haven't seen that's necessary to preserve air. I do know with motions to continue, missing witnesses or something like that, there are some areas of the law where you do have to request and file a sworn motion to continue to preserve air. But I haven't seen that in this sort of context, and his objection was overruled. So I believe at that point he did the preservation necessary.
Trying to figure out through your oral argument which path are you suggesting that we follow, which path in terms of which courts of appeals guideline in terms of reviewing something of this nature, or do you not believe that there's been anything that is right on point?
And I know your time is over, but please answer the question if you can.
I'm not so sure that there's anything right on point other than the Golihar case. That footnote 12, I think, is pretty clear that sufficiency review, variances, materiality of a variance, that's not necessarily, respectfully, I don't think that's where this court should be going on this. I think this court needs to focus on Burrell and just general amendment versus abandonment law to make its decision on whether there was an error.
Thank you, counsel, and we'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Chief Justice Byrne, may it please the court.
Certainly.
I'm going to start with that question you just had, Your Honor, because I think that's the key point is, did Golihar in 2001 change the law for 2810 inquiries? And I think this court has four paths it can go, and I'll walk us through those four. And so the first path is my counsel says footnote 12, this only Golihar only dealt with sufficiency analysis. Well, it's correct that it only dealt with sufficiency analysis, but that footnote 12 is from Presiding Judge Keller's concurring opinion, and she did not join a majority in that one. And so path number one, Golihar didn't change anything. If that's the case, the state concedes its error because the Burrell exception will still be alive. And tracking with McDonald, a 1940 case where the state added gross to gross negligence, and Burrell, where the state added with malice aforethought, the state adding this unnecessary mens rea of intentionally and knowingly, that would be error with that case law. And then the inquiry would become, after its error, whether it's harm. And counsel was briefly talking about this, that the 1990 Sodipo case said it was mandatory reversal, but the Court of Criminal Appeals 10 years later in Wright versus State implicitly overruled Sodipo because it was faced with a 2010 error and the Court of Criminal Appeals found no harm. And several courts of appeal have since then applied harm analysis to this question. The second path is what this court took in Hosager, the non-published case from 2015, and what the Waco court took in Alston. There, they basically, the court said, Gully Hara overruled the Burrell exception, and the question we're going to ask ourselves is, was this language legally essential to the offense? And basically saying, hey, we're just going to say if it's surplusage, you can strike it, no error. Now, the fundamental issue with that problem is it cherry picks from the majority opinion from Gully Hara, because the courts basically say the Burrell exception is overruled, but it doesn't also continue and say, well, surplusage law in general was overruled as well. So there's a little tension there. The third path, which in the state's opinion is the soundest path for the law, is what the Texarkana Court of Appeals took in Briscoe. And there to say, well, Gully Hara asked this question post-conviction. And the question we're going to ask is the variance material. And what's a material variance is whether or not the variance implicates a substantial right to the defendant. It's essentially the error is a harm analysis. And the two questions that the court asks is, does this subject the defendant to being tried again for the same offense by striking the language? Or by striking the language, does this not allow the defendant to prepare an adequate defense? And so what the Waco court does is, forget about surplusage, we don't consider that anymore, but if the state strikes the language from the charging instrument, those two inquiries follow. Does the defendant face potential being charged again for the same type of offense and for the same fact pattern? Or does this no longer provide adequate notice for the defendant to prepare an adequate defense? And so the Waco approach harmonizes pre-conviction and post-conviction jurisprudence, because if not, as the Texarkana court put, you can't remove the state's forbidden from striking information from the charging instrument, but guess what? An appellate court is going to just ignore that language anyways.
So you're saying that at the time that you strike it, the defendant isn't quite sure whether or not on review what their remedy is going to be, because the appeals court is going to look at the whole case mm-hmm. to see whether there's going to be harm. Mm-hmm. So at the time that it's happening, they've got to preserve everything.
Correct.
Expecting that, you know, they've got to dot their I's, cross their T's with every objection, asking for continuance, asking for objections, asking for everything, because in the full look back of the entire record is only the time in which we're going to know whether there's harm.
Mm-hmm. And Your Honor, for that is, if that's the case here, the defendant can object and say, which he did, but he can ask for a continuance, which he did not. The defendant can also say, hey, Your Honor, the striking this language, this actually completely changes my defensive theory for trial. Time out. We can't go ahead right now. I need to talk with my client. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that happened today, that happened at the case. And secondly, in this specific case, it would not have changed any defensive theory. Because again, as appellant concedes, the issue for the defendant was whether or not he could prove his justification defense by preponderance of the evidence, whether or not he can explain to the jury that when he showed the videos, it was done for an educational purpose.
And can you dig deeper into that with regard to his argument about burden shifting? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, what you state did shifted burdens to him.
Yes, Your Honor. So I don't think there was any burden shifting at all. The legislature has determined that there's an affirmative defense for this offense And affirmative defenses by the legislature have dictated that the burden is on the defendant to prove that affirmative defense by preponderance of the evidence. The state in the charging instrument also alleged, which tracked the statute, that the defendant had to know the material was harmful. And the state had to prove that, and it did prove that. The added mens rea affected one of the three elements in the case. It affected the display element, intentionally and knowingly display. And even if that language were not stricken and the state still had to prove it, it did, because that was an issue that was never contested in trial. And the reason was that the defendant himself admitted to the detectives that he did, in fact, show these videos, and he was just justifying it to the detectives at the time, and then later at trial, that was done for the purposes of education, which is the affirmative defense. So I don't think there's any burden shifting at all by the removal of this intentionally and knowingly language to the display element, because that element was never in dispute. And then second, that even if the state did prove that, which we believe we did, the burden always remained on the defendant to show that the affirmative defense applied in this situation. And the jury did not buy that in this case.
Can we discuss, though, any potential possibility of him being tried again for a different crime related to this based on the alteration of the charge?
Now, and so the inquiry to look at that is appellate courts are allowed to review the whole record. And so it's not just looking at the charging instrument going forward and say, hey, this language in the charging instrument doesn't necessarily match another potential offense. You look at the whole facts. And here it will show the videos that the defendant himself admitted to showing to the complaining witness and also the testimony of the complaining witness itself. So anything that was discussed in trial, no go. And so I don't think that is the concern for the defendant in this situation. And then going forward, I mentioned four paths. If this court does not want to wrestle with the hard issue of what should be the law and analysis for 2810 inquiries, it of course can always just assume error and decide on the harm question. But I think prosecutions, defendants, and trial judges would appreciate some clarity in terms of what exactly is the analysis when a state says, whoa, we messed up on the charging instrument. This language is not needed for the offense. We're going to strike it. What are the questions that the trial judge should ask, and how should a trial judge rule? And I think that goes back. The most coherent thing is a materiality test, which is the same thing for the variance, because it will ask just two inquiries. And if the judge is any concerned that a defensive theory has changed, the right answer there would be, you know what? You can't change the amendment. You can't change the charging instrument. And or here's 10 days that you have to prepare for the new charging instrument.
And there was no request, just following up on the chief's question previously, there was no request for a continuance?
There was no request for a continuance, Your Honor. It was just an objection, and the defense counsel, the trial counsel said, we want the state to prove what they alleged. And then lastly, I want to say is if this court says that there is no error, it's the state's position that there is no harm. As I was briefly saying before, this removing that language does not affect potential double jeopardy in this case. There was no defensive theory that was implicated by the removal of this language, because that element of the display that was taken for granted based on the defendant's own admissions. And then third, again, there was no burden shifting, because the defendant always had the burden to show that his actions were justified via an education defense.
You believe the Burrell exception still applies?
The state's position is the third one, the Texarkana court and Briscoe approach, saying that to harmonize the law, let's just say Gully Har, let's stand by what the majority said in Gully Har, saying that Burrell exception and general surplusage law was overruled, and let's apply that in the 2810 context as well. And I think that's sounder than what this court did in a non-published opinion and what the Waco court, which just said, basically, if it's not legally essential, you can strike it, no error at all. Here, at least in the Texarkana approach in Briscoe, you have that, the defense has that ability to say, hey, wait a second, my defensive theory is changing with this striking of the language, or my client's going to be potentially facing being tried again, I need a timeout, or you can't do it. So it has that safety valve built in that a court can conduct an analysis of whether or not it actually makes a difference. Yeah. Yeah. So it's the state's position for the clearest version of the law would be saying that you apply a material analysis, a test for 2810 inquiries. And the second best case scenario, just for clarity of law, would be the first approach, which would be the presiding judge Keller footnote 12, which say these are two different inquiries, let's not confuse the issues. And that will at least provide clarity to the prosecutors and defenses and trial judges on how you conduct a 2810 inquiry. So pending other questions, the state requests that this court affirms the judgment of the trial court and provide some clarity to the law. Thank you.
Any questions, judges? Thank you. Thank you. Let us hear further from the appellant. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Just to be very brief, I do agree with Mr. Ludmeer that we definitely would appreciate analysis on this, especially as a defense attorney. At least when I go to trial, I always carry case law with me on whatever various issues that I see can pop up, and I find that to be very helpful for me. I will say, I respectfully submit that if you were to determine that this is surplusage, then I think the holding there would be that anything additional placed into a charging document is automatically surplusage. That would be the holding, because it's pretty clear here that an additional element wrongfully was placed into the information. So I guess if that's the decision the court were to make there, the only way you would have an amendment is if it was to a real element in the statute that you decided to change. And I do not think that's the law. Even going through the Texarkana case that Mr. Ludmeer is citing, and going into sufficiency analysis, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in Golihar made clear when you're doing that variance and sufficiency analysis, you actually have to do it to the hypothetically correct jury charge as is in the charging document. So if the charging document puts additional elements in there and you're doing a sufficiency review, you're going to have to then meet those elements that you placed, the state placed, into the charging document, even though they did so unnecessarily, which they 100% did here, no doubt. So based upon all of that, and just to also add about the defensive theory, it was pretty clear through the facts that my client's defensive theory was that this was done for educational purposes. That's what he said in his statement without counsel. That is also to what his wife testified about, that this was done for educational purposes. So based upon all that, the elimination of an element that was placed into the charging document, we are respectfully requesting that this court reverse the judgment.
Thank you. Thank you, counsels, very much for the presentation. And this case will be submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you very much.